If you're just joining us, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump, they continue this week. You can hear live coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our NPR News and Classical Music Network is broadcasting the hearings today. That's live coverage of the public impeachment inquiry hearings on the NPR News and Classical Music Network and online at WPR.org. So right now we're taking a look at the second week of public hearings. We're talking about the testimony of nine more witnesses over 3 days. What evidence from the inquiry to date are you most interested in? What are impeachable offenses to you? What questions do you have about the public phase and what happens next? We're at 800-642-1234. Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. Elisa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me back.
So last week we heard from high-level Ukraine diplomats, including acting Ambassador William Taylor and former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. They bring us to today. Who are we hearing from today?
Today we will have Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who has testified before, as well as Jennifer Williams, who is a special aide to the Vice President of the United States. She also has testified before in private or in closed sessions with this particular committee. So these are the two, I think, that are who are testifying today that that a lot of people are really focusing their attention on and are really interested to see what their testimony will be in this public setting.
So Jennifer Williams, a foreign service aide who was apparently listening in on the July 25th call between President Trump and President Zelensky. What might we learn there from Jennifer Williams?
Well, I think she certainly may have, you know, some new information to add. I think what the at least from the Democrats, you know, the Democrats' point of view, what impact she will have is last week we heard from a lot of the Republicans, was that we were hearing secondhand information, hearsay. You know, somebody told somebody who told somebody, that, you know, the whole telephone chain sort of thing. And so with Williams having been on the call and hearing the call, you know, live as it happened, and the fact that she, you know, afterwards said that she had spoke to her superiors and talked about how she was concerned with that particular call, finding it inappropriate. I think it's more, you know, a person who was there, who was listening, who was, you know, in the moment and made the conclusion that it was a, you know, concerning and inappropriate phone call.
What strikes me is that we're learning more and more people who were on this call. And it got me thinking last night, like, how many people were listening in on this?
Right. I mean, and it's common for, you know, especially for, I mean, it's for a phone call coming from a, you know, not a cell phone, but necessarily, but a connection through the White House. And especially given that it was a connection to the, you know, a leader of a foreign nation, there's going to be lots of, you know, attaches, lots of aides and individuals who are, you know, part of this or who listen, not part of the conversation, listening in, especially if it's their, you know, region or their area or of some reason they're very interested in the, you know, this particular phone call.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has testified behind closed doors. What was the political reaction to his private testimony?
So his testimony is very interesting. He is, a Purple Heart, Iraq vet. He has served in this country, you know, since he was able to. Him and his twin brother have both served for in the nation's armed forces. And he, at age of three, his family immigrated from Ukraine. And so at least in terms of the, you know, what a lot of pundits or a lot of certain news were discussing was his loyalties and his perhaps ethnic ties to Ukraine and whether or not that is influencing him in this particular instance. And so, which, I mean, there's no evidence whatsoever that he has been influenced, you know, that he's a traitor. There was some instances of people calling him traitor, you know, of him not being loyal to the U.S. And there's absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. However, given the fact that that was the most common critique against him after his testimony, it'll be interesting to see today how Republicans in particular decide to question, to push back, to see if they, you know, push on some of these themes, or if they respect, you know, that he is a, you know, part of the NSC. He is, you know, a decorated military veteran, and will respect that and will assume that he, you know, like other servings, are just loyal Americans.
We're talking with Elisa von Hagel. She's an associate professor of political science at UW Superior. Have you been paying attention to the impeachment hearings? What are your thoughts? What stuck out to you so far? Are there particular moments that really made you think? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris now in Exonia. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Yeah, I got to say that I paid attention, and I was not a Trump fan, but this is getting just absolutely ridiculous. It is entirely political, and it's evidenced by, you know, the Congressman Schiff's staff helping to write the whistleblower complaint. It's just asinine what the Democrats are doing, and it's making me more supportive of Trump.
Chris, thank you so much for that call. Elisa, Chris is really disgusted by this whole process and this inquiry. What do you make of that as a political scientist?
I think that there is a lot of, you know, if not apathy, of, you know, rising, you know, concern or hostility about all of the, you know, investigations of all of this that's been going on. And it is, I mean, it's very tiresome. It's very emotionally tiresome. I know I myself find, you know, I get, you know, sick and tired of all, you know, the new people, the new, you know, the new breaking news headlines and all of that. And so I think people are generally getting very, you know, again, just apathetic towards the, you know, these open hearings itself and just the process in general. And just one comment that the caller had mentioned was that this was a clearly political process. And actually, it's supposed to be a political process. It's not a criminal process. The Constitution laid out a clearly, you know, political process, and by which that legislators can recall or remove the president from office for not fulfilling his duties, for violating the authority of his office. And so by that, I mean, so I know he didn't necessarily perhaps mean it in that way, but I think that we get very much focused on, you know, the use of, you know, language or lingo from criminal trials or that. And it's, you know, it's important to remember that this is not a criminal trial, and it is a political process, and it is meant to be so.
Let's bring in Tim now in Whitewater. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, I'm kind of in agreement with your previous caller, and I would like to, I guess both of you to remind the fact that it really doesn't matter what I or you or the professor or whoever says is an impeachable offense. What does matter is how that is defined by the law. And too often I see, you know, people nowadays go, well, I think it is. Well, that really doesn't matter. It's defined by the rules of impeachment. So it doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, or whatever. An impeachable offense has to meet that criteria. And that's, I think, where people get confused. Well, I don't like Trump, or I do like Trump, and it is or isn't. Well, it doesn't matter, because there's a law, there's criteria involved.
Yeah, Tim, thank you so much. Elisa, what articles of impeachment are being discussed?
There are articles of impeachment being discussed, I believe, concerning obstruction of justice, of violating the authority of the office or the power given to the president itself. There is also potentially, I'm not sure of as of yet, but I believe there's talk of bribery perhaps being one of the articles of impeachment being drawn up. So that information is obviously, so it's the House Judiciary Committee that will actually draw up the articles of impeachment, and the House Intelligence Committee that is conducting hearings right now are simply doing investigative work of doing the background informational, you know, gathering information. And so we won't you know, we just won't know what those articles of impeachment will be until the House Judiciary Committee convenes to draft some of those articles, if they choose to do so.
And if the House approves articles of impeachment, what will the Senate do then?
As of right now, it seems so there would go before the Senate for the Senate to act again, essentially as a trial to make a determination based on the evidence gathered by the House on these articles or charges of impeachment. And as of right now, it seems that the Republicans are still maintaining, you know, their unity on this issue, are still opposed to removal of the president. And so as of again, right now, it does seem that that the president would not be removed, most likely, given what we know so far.
And the Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, completes when it completes its work, it writes a report. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. It will write its report and write a recommendation of what they determine would be, you know, just cause or what would be the ideal response to all of this. And certainly the Judiciary Committee will take that recommendation into account, but they also will consider and evaluate the evidence that they are provided, whether it's testimony or some other written materials, documents that they are provided to, that will, again, be the, you know, quote unquote, evidence of, you know, certain charges or, you know, other charges.
We're talking with UW Superior political scientist Elisa von Hagel about the House impeachment inquiry process. What happens this week, the second week of the public phase? Are you following the testimony? What are you watching for? What outcomes would be plausible to you given what you know so far from witness testimony and depositions? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this in a moment with Elisa von Hagel here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the second week of the public phase of the House impeachment inquiry. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. 9 witnesses testifying over 3 days. And then we heard President Trump yesterday in morning tweets say he would strongly consider testifying in writing as part of the inquiry. What do you think of that? What do you think of the public phase and what you've learned so far? What questions do you have about the inquiry and how it works? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. UW Superior political scientist Elisa von Hagel stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Rich is joining us from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Thanks to Professor von Hagel. I really do want to say that the expression of surprise that by callers or others that many people listen in on phone calls reassures me, because government policy does not start with one person in our system of government. That is, if a president comes into office, he recognizes long-standing policies and he may want to modify them. But in cases where bribery may be at issue, we do indeed have to listen to what other people in the government say was going on. And it's, we don't live under one man or one woman rule in this country. We have checks and balances. And so I'm watching and I'm paying strict attention. And this isn't making me like President Trump better, I'll tell you that.
Rich, thank you for your thoughts. And Elisa, this kind of edges closer toward, as we, you know, hear the testimony of people listening in on this call about whether there was quid pro quo. One of the most anticipated witnesses is Gordon Sondland on this, U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who in laying out quid pro quo changed his testimony and said something different. He changed his story. So what do you make of that? And how do you think Democrats and Republicans are going to frame that?
That was quite surprising, to be perfectly honest. So he had offered his testimony prior to this and had, you know, basically stated he didn't recall or he didn't, you know, believe that there was any precondition on military aid for Ukraine, or, you know, that he just wasn't aware of anything and, you know, used a lot of, you know, obfuscating language. And given the testimony of a number of individuals who basically declared that he, you know, was aware of and had conversations with the president about this the precondition of investigation for military aid, he and his lawyer, through his lawyer, offered a 3-page amendment to his submission of his report, and that basically stated that he now recalled what he had known. And so how he will be treated by Democrats and Republicans on Wednesday when he comes to testify is anyone's guess. I imagine that the Republicans will treat him a bit more hostile in terms of his testimony, given the fact that he is confirming that, in fact, he did, you know, that he is, I guess, basically substantiating that there was this quid pro quo that the president was aware of. How the Democrats will treat him as based upon his addition or changing testimony, it's anyone's guess how this plays out. And it will be very, I think, very fascinating to see how he also is, you know, how far or how much he is willing to share and how much he is willing to state in his testimony.
Well, of course, this is all taking place in the shadow of the 2020 presidential election. What task do Democrats have before them, politically speaking, and what are they trying to accomplish here as a major election looms?
I do believe that they want this impeachment inquiry to happen fairly quick basis, as some of your callers earlier have noted that, and again, as many people have said, you know, that it is getting tiresome. It's getting, you know, that it's just, it seems to be never ending, these investigations. And so they're aware that this cannot go on for 2 years. This cannot happen for, you know, months and months and months. And so they will most likely be attempting to wrap up the inquiry as quickly as possible, and would then be hoping to get this, their report and information and recommendations to the Judiciary Committee, you know, again, as soon as possible. I've heard projections of, you know, before Christmas, of, you know, around Thanksgiving time for the Judiciary Committee to be making its decision. So they want to be moving forward on this as quickly as possible.
Elisa, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Elisa von Hagel is an associate professor of political science at UW-Superior. Truax Field Air National Guard Base in Madison is one of the Air Force's preferred locations for a new set of advanced fighter jets called F-35s. Local opponents say the noise of the jets will disrupt life in neighborhoods around the airport, and they're clashing with supporters who say the F-35s will secure the future of the base. Miranda Suarez reports.
For people who want F-35s at Truax Field, what happened to Milwaukee's General Mitchell Air Reserve Station is a warning. In 2005, a Base Realignment and Closure, or BRAC Commission, recommended that the station shut down. So it was up to Wisconsin's elected officials to convince the commission to keep General Mitchell as the home of the 440th Airlift Wing.
Members of the 440th have over 4,500 combined hours of flying and maintenance experience, and the loss of that experience will have a negative effect on combat readiness.
That's former Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle. His argument didn't work. The base closed in 2008, and the 440th moved to North Carolina. F-35 supporters in Madison say Truax could meet the same fate if it doesn't replace its old F-16 jets. Greater Madison Chamber of Commerce President Zach Brandon says the F-35s would strengthen the current and future economic impact of the base.
The loss of the F-16s by not getting the F-35s is like losing the home games of the Packers or the home games of the Milwaukee Bucks. And I think if we were thinking about it in those contexts, nobody would be willing to risk the loss of those sporting teams in order to sort of roll the dice and see what might happen.
Brandon says the base already contributes $100 million to the state economy each year. And to place the F-35s, the Air Force says it would hire hundreds of temporary construction workers and up to 64 permanent personnel. The last BRAC commission in 2005 did take economic impact into account, but the most important criteria was a base's current and future mission capabilities. Former Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson spoke to a Senate committee last year about a similar F-35 debate in Burlington, Vermont.
If the F-35s don't go to Vermont, the F-16s would eventually age out, and it's highly likely that Vermont would no longer have a flying mission for its guard.
She also told the committee that since the Cold War ended, there are far fewer missions to go around. A BRAC commission has never recommended closing Truax, and the base has two other missions besides flying fighter jets, bomb disposal and homeland defense. Local F-35 opponent Amelia Royko-Maurer says the base should have a disaster response mission instead of the F-35s.
There are alternatives, alternate missions that could take place here for the Air National Guard. It doesn't need to be the F-35.
An Air Force report says the F-35s will increase the area of noise exposure around Truax, which would disproportionately impact low-income people and people of color. Community activist Brandy Grayson used to live near the airport. She says Madison shouldn't have to choose between the 1,200 people who work at Truax and equality for everyone else.
1,200 people losing their job is a huge deal, but thousands of people and thousands of vulnerable people is also a big deal. And protecting our children and the most vulnerable should be our focus as a community that says that we're progressive.
George Schlossberg, an attorney and BRAC expert, says it's possible for bases to get new missions. And he says base closures aren't always an economic disaster.
Some of the most vibrant communities are those that have had base closures because they've taken those former assets and they've converted them, you know, for industry, housing, development.
Regardless, Schlossberg says not to expect another round of base closures anytime soon.
We have a much more divisive political environment, and we have a much more uncertain and unsettled world.
The Air Force's decision is expected in the spring. Miranda Suarez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.